This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Our guest Quincy Jones started his career as a trumpeter in Lionel Hampton's big band in the early 50s. Jones never became a noted instrumentalist. What made him famous and wealthy was his work as an arranger, composer, producer, and media mogul, work that spans the big bands through bebop, pop, movie soundtracks, TV themes, and hip-hop. He's arranged or produced recordings for Frank Sinatra, Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, Dinah Washington, George Benson, James Ingram, and Ice-T. And he produced the Michael Jackson mega-hit Thriller. Terry Gross spoke with Quincy Jones in 2001 about his memoir called Q. He had just put out a 4-CD box set of music featuring him as a trumpeter, arranger, composer, or producer. Here's a sampling.
Another bride, another June, another sunny honeymoon, another season, another reason for making whoopee. I never cared much for moonlit skies. I never winked back at fireflies. But now that the stars are in your eyes, I'm beginning to see the light. Look at me. I'm as helpless as a kitten up a tree. And I feel like I'm clinging to a cloud I can't understand. I get misty just holding your hand.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on a Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me.
Sampling of tracks from the Quincy Jones retrospective CD box set called Q, also the title of his autobiography. One of the first musicians he came to know well was Ray Charles. They met when they were both teenagers. Terry asked him about their friendship.
You said that you admired Ray Charles' independence. He was 16 years old. He was blind, but he had his own apartment. He got around town himself. He had a girlfriend. I mean, he had a lot of things that you wanted.
Yes, he did. He had his own apartment, too, in two suits. It was amazing. And but what I guess what impressed me the most with Ray is that he was so independent, and his sightlessness did not hinder him at all. It's one of the treasured, cherished friendships that I really have, because as kids, we used to talk about everything. He'd show me how to write music in Braille. Dizzy Gillespie songs like Eminon and Bebop, etc. And we used to dream about the future. Like, wouldn't it be great to work with a symphony orchestra? One day we're going to do that. One day we're going to have three girlfriends each, you know. One day we're going to do movies together. We're going to do all of that stuff. And we did it. That's what's amazing. We did In the Heat of the Night together. And we did We the World, all of those things. Everything, the girls. It's amazing to dream and have your dreams executed like that. And
I thought I'd play a 1959 recording that you arranged for Ray Charles, and this is from the Genius of Ray Charles album, which was recorded in 1959. We're going to hear "Let the Good Times Roll." Would you like to say anything about this track?
I would just like to add that we had half of Count Basie's band on that session and half of Duke Ellington's band on that session. And in those days, that's when I first started to work with Phil Ramone, the engineer, who's now a producer. And Ahmet Erdogan, Neshiwi Erdogan, and Jerry Wexler came by because in those days, what you heard was what you got. It wasn't about fixing in the mix. There was nothing to mix.
This is Ray Charles, arrangement by Quincy Jones, "Let the Good Times Roll."
And when you're dead, you're done. So let the good time roll. I say let the good time roll. I don't care if you're young or old. You ought to get together and let the good time roll. Don't sit there mumbling, talking trash. If you want to have a ball, you got to go out and spend some cash. And let the good time roll now. I'm talking about the good times. Well, it makes no difference whether you're young or old. All you got to do is get together and let the good time roll.
Ray Charles recorded in 1959 from the album The Genius of Ray Charles. The arrangement is by my guest Quincy Jones. He has a new autobiography. Quincy Jones also has a new 4-CD box set that spans his whole career. Your first important music job was with the Lionel Hampton Big Band. You got that job while you were still in high school. How did he hire you when you were still in school?
Well, I had written a suite that I've been working on for a long time called From the Four Winds. And it was almost a descriptive piece. And I didn't understand theory too well then, but I just went ahead straight. It didn't stop me from writing. I didn't understand key signatures or anything. And I would say silly things on the top of a trumpet part, like a note. When you play B naturals, make the B naturals a half step lower because they sound funny if they're B naturals. And some guy said, "Idiot, just put a flat on the third line and it's a key signature." And so I did, because it didn't bother me that I didn't understand it, because I knew eventually I'd learn it. And so I gave this arrangement to, submitted this to Lionel Hampton. And he said, "You wrote this, huh?" I said, "Yeah." "You play trumpet too?" He said, "Yeah." Well, he said, "How'd you like to join my band, please?" Are you kidding? And so I had they had little brown leather bags for your trumpet then. I had that and just very few toilet articles and so forth. And I went and sat on that bus so nobody would change their mind and I wouldn't have to ask the people at home whether I could go or not. And sure enough, everybody got on one by one. Hamp said hi and I felt secure. Then Gladys Hampton got on the bus and said, "Uh-uh. What is that child doing on this bus?" And she said, "No, son, you get off the bus." And said, "We'll try to talk later, but you go to school." And I was destroyed. And so I got a scholarship to Boston, to the Berklee College of Music. And I got the call. A friend named Janet Thurlow was singing with the band, and she reminded them. And they called and said, "We'd like you to be with the band." I was 18 then, and I was ready. And I told the school I'd be back, but I guess down inside, you know, when you go with a band like that, you never go back.
Now you said that you were afraid that when you were playing with Hampton, that Parker or Thelonious Monk might show up in the audience, and you were worried they'd laugh at what you had to wear in the band. What did you have to wear in the Hampton band?
Well, that incident happened when we were playing at a place on Broadway called right next door to Birdland. I mean, totally adjacent. And it was down. Both places were downstairs, and we had to wear Tyrolean hats, purple shawl collared coats, and Bermuda shorts.
Bermuda shorts? Why?
Oh, my God. The whole band.
Why did you have to wear shorts?
Oh, I don't know. That's just Hamp's idea. Hamp was like a rock and roll band, and he was the first rock and roll band because he attacked an audience like a rock and roll band. No prisoners, and he knew how to get them, too.
Well, some of the tenor solos were almost like a rock and roll band, too, yeah.
Yes, and they'd walk in the theaters. They'd walk. They had thin-soled shoes. They'd walk over the audience's heads with these thin-soled shoes on top of their chairs, you know. It was absolutely incredible. And he had this sense of show business, but he had a lot of music in the band because, you know, they had people like Wes Montgomery and Charlie Mingus and Fats Navarro, Clifford Brown, amazing musicians in the band. And I loved Hamp for having that ambidexterity because he liked great music, but he also liked to level his audience and take no prisoners. Until they were wrung out, he was not satisfied.
So did any of your bebop friends end up seeing you in that band that night?
Well, that particular night, he had this favorite thing he'd like to do. He'd have everybody, he'd get his drumsticks and start a whole line, almost like a conga line, and the saxophone section would follow him around the audience, and he'd go around and beat the drumsticks on everybody's table. The trumpets and trombones were right behind him, playing Flying Home. Then he'd go upstairs. I said, oh, my God. Clifford Brown and I said, if he goes upstairs, we may run into Charlie Parker and Bud Powell and all Mingus and all these great musicians. And Hamp went upstairs, and he's playing his drumsticks all over the awnings, and the guys are saying, what is going on here? He'd even go so far as to get in a taxi cab with the saxophone section and go to another club maybe three blocks away and play with the saxophone section, the band back at the ranch. We're still playing. So, It was quite an experience. He had no shame, and he was a great musician. One of the great times of my life.
So, but did Parker see you in your Bermuda shorts?
Oh yes, but on top of that, Parker would come next door. Bird would come next door. He loved to read music, and he was starring next door with like the 52nd Street All Stars, the Bebop All Stars, and they were looking for him next door. It's time for him to play a set, and he's sitting over there in our band playing second tenor because he loved to read music. And he's sitting for an hour while people are next door waiting to hear him as this genius of the 20th century, and he's over there playing second tenor parts to practice his reading because all the musicians read music back then.
Now, I got to move to a 1962 recording. This is The Soul Bossa Nova, which became the theme for Austin Powers, the
yes,
movie.
Yes, it did.
Which just goes to show how this epitomizes a certain 60s sound. What was the occasion for writing this originally?
We had just come back from two State Department tours with Dizzy Gillespie. The first was in the Middle East, place of Pakistan, right there, you know, Abadan and Iran and Syria. Beirut, and we came back to the White House Correspondents' Ball in Washington, and they liked what we had done, and so they sent us out to South America after that. And so we went down to Argentina first, in Buenos Aires, and when we got to Brazil, Dizzy played with the rhythm section, samba rhythm section at the Gloria Hotel one afternoon, and sitting in the front row with three teenagers, a married couple, Astrid and Joao Gilberto, and Antonio Carlos Jobim, who started a whole bossa nova movement. And ironically, the first record that came out in the United States was Desafinado. And the melody on the first, just the first opening strain was just almost pure Dizzy Gillespie. That's why they referred to it at that time as jazz and samba, before they even called it bossa nova. And so we came home all excited about this new music. They had moved the clave beat, which is really like the foundation of Latin music, straight up and down Latin America. That's the foundation of the clave beat, is the guiding force. And I wanted to record some of this stuff. And so I made a thing called Big Band Bossa Nova, and I wrote in about 20 minutes, this is 1962, a tune called Soul Bossa Nova.
Well, let's hear your 1962 recording of Soul Bossa Nova, which later became the theme for Austin Powers.
Shagadelic. Behave. He is so funny.
talk about your childhood. Your early years were spent on the south side of Chicago. Your father was a carpenter, and you say that he worked for the guys who ran the rackets in the south side. How did he end up being their carpenter?
Well, you know, that was the Chicago during the Depression in the ghetto. Nobody asked any questions. You know, Chicago also was the spawning ground of every, probably the headquarters spawning ground of every gangster in America, black or white. You know, Roger Tooley, Dillinger, Capone, everybody. So the Jones Boys were just, they were one of the first black gangsters. They started the Policy Rackets, and they also had a Five and Dime store, chain, the Jones Five and Dime, which they used to call the V's and X's. So I'm going to make a trip over to the V's and X's today.
So these were the Jones Boys your father worked for. This isn't the Quincy Jones family you're talking
no,
about.
No.
Right.
They were the gangsters in the back in the day.
Your mother was a Christian Scientist. Did she bring you up in your early years as a Christian Scientist?
I think so. If I can remember, she went to Boston University probably in the 20s, which was very unusual, you know, for African American female in those days, and she. Very smart lady. She spoke and wrote like 12 languages, including Hebrew, everything. And she typed 100 words a minute. And so she was like kind of the administrator, superintendent of one of the places we lived in, like the Rosenwald, before we got into a house.
Your mother was later diagnosed as schizophrenic, and she was institutionalized for a while. What were some of her problems at home before she was actually diagnosed, problems that you found disturbing?
Well, it's dementia praecox, which is schizophrenia. She was obsessed with religion, all forms of religion. And I didn't understand that at that time, but I don't really know what happened. You know, the families don't really tell you what the bottom line is, so. But she would stare out of the window, and she would sing spirituals. She'd play spirituals, was just erratic at times. And I remember when I was about 5 years old, my birthday party, she threw my coconut cake out the back off the back porch, and it was really a big deal to me then. I don't know why I remember that so much, but it was really. Something I couldn't understand because the cake was supposed to be like the symbol or the metaphor for the joy of the birthday party. You know, that's the object that you...
Right.
The campfire. And she threw it out, and it just really shocked me. And it was a very traumatic moment. And I know it sounds like it's nothing.
No, it doesn't sound like it's nothing.
At 5 years old, it freaked me out. And I realized, my brother and I both realized something was wrong. I mean, every day we realized something was wrong because it was just... it just wasn't like other people's parents. Even the bad parents, it wasn't the same as that. It was
right.
Because she was very smart. And so finally she was committed, and I didn't know or kind of blanked out what the process was until I went back there, like 50 years later when I did Listen Up. All of it came back, and I guess that's the part of the book that was cathartic. There were missing pieces in my memory, and it got clarified.
I want to get back to your music and to get to the most colossal success that you had, and that was the album Thriller with Michael Jackson. What was your approach to producing Thriller? What did you think of as your major contributions to the sound of that record?
Thriller was a combination of all my experience as an orchestrator and picking the songs, and Michael's all the talents he has as a dancer, as a singer, as an amazing entertainer. It was like us throwing everything we accumulated experience, putting it all together.
Well, let's hear Billie Jean. I really regret we're out of time. I wish we could talk some more. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure, Terry.
Terry Gross spoke with Quincy Jones in 2001. Today is his 75th birthday. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. Happy birthday, Q.